Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Kara Keehan. Today we'll discuss the recently published article titled "The Long-Term Variability of Human Health Related to Solar Ultraviolet B Radiation Doses for the 1980s to the End of the 21st Century." Joining me are Editor-in-Chief Dr. Sadi Matalan and lead author Dr. Christos Zerifos. Let's learn more. Dr. Matalan?
Thank you, Kara. Welcome to Physiological Reviews podcast. As Kara mentioned, I am Sadi Matalan, and I am pleased beyond belief to be talking today with Professor Christos Zerifos, Secretary General of the Academy of Athens, which is the National Academy of Greece. Listeners, I am proud to say that Physiological Reviews solicits and publishes highly authoritative, non-biased, and informative reviews that are highly cited by basic, translational, and clinical scientists engaged in biomedical research and patient care. The journal is the most cited physiology journal in the world and among the top 50 most influential journals indexed in PubMed, Web of Science, and other scientific databases. Last year, we asked two highly respected scientists to contribute comprehensive reviews on the effects of climate change on respiratory health. Today, we are fortunate to host Professor Zerifos, the senior author of an in-depth review on the long-term variability of human health related to solar ultraviolet B radiation. Professor Zerifos, it is an honor to have you. And listeners, let me take 2 minutes to tell you about his distinguished career. Professor Zerifos is the Secretary General of the Academy of Athens, Climate Envoy for Greece, Head of the Research Center for Atmospheric Physics and Climatology of the Academy of Athens. In addition, he is Professor Emeritus of the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens and of the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki in Greece. He has received too many awards to mention. I'm just going to mention some of them. He has received the Order of Honor from the President of the Hellenic Republic in Greece, the French Government Decoration, Commandeur de l'Ordre de Palme Académique in 2015, and the Global Ozone Award, awarded at the 10th anniversary of the Montreal Protocol. And this is a great, indeed, award. Professor Zerifos, in 1992, you authored an article in Science, the most prestigious publication for all aspects of science, titled "Measurement Trends in Stratospheric Ozone." This article has been cited 725 times. How do changes in the concentration of stratospheric ozone impact on human health and the ecosystem? What are the main factors that may adversely affect the concentration of ozone in the stratosphere?
Thank you, Professor Matalon, and I'm humbled by your welcome and your extremely kind words. Thank you so much. Ozone is the protective layer that screens the harmful UVB solar radiation. It can damage humans and the ecosystems. That radiation, part of it, is responsible for our reddening when we expose our skin to the sun, particularly in our summer vacation. So we all know about it. But it can have in excess doses, which can happen when ozone is depleted or reduced in its screening ability, can result also to effects in the eyes. Cataracts are thought to be affected also by UVB solar radiation. And the ecosystems, many important ecosystems like the bees and other insects, they are influenced because they use solar UVA and UVB particularly in their navigation towards the flowers. So it is of great importance to keep life on Earth. Now, in your question, which are the main factors that adversely affect the ozone layer? We know now, after 40 years and more of ozone research, that ozone is maintained in the stratosphere, which is above our flights, above our international flights. It's a layer that practically starts at 15 kilometer heights and goes up to 40 kilometers and more. But the bulk of protection becomes of the lower, so-called lower ozone layer, which is between, say, 18 and 23 kilometer height. This part of ozone is controlled by dynamics and by photochemical reactions. And so there are two major factors that they control its abundance and its ability to protect life on Earth. Occasionally, large volcanic eruptions can interrupt and influence ozone and its protection activity and capability. So these effects are transient. They have happened recently after the Mount Pinatubo eruption, the most recent, and after last year's eruption in the tropics. But they do not last long. And we now know that the chemical reactions were responsible because humans have released chlorofluorocarbons, so-called CFCs, substances produced globally in industrial processes and in everyday life of great use, from plastics to cleaning of electronics and many other applications, and propellants in spray cans. Now they have been abandoned with the Montreal Protocol because these substances, they are inert and they can go up in the stratosphere where the sun is photolyzing them, releasing chlorine and bromine atoms and molecules that they can affect and they reduce the ozone abundance there. This is the chemical destruction, but dynamical changes, of course, that are always there. And we have the stratosphere is being warmed by ozone itself because it absorbs this solar UVB radiation, and at the same time, it is protecting us from the lethal part of UVB and UVC.
Thank you very much, Professor Zerefos. I'm fascinated about what you said about the bees. I did not know that this is highly interesting. In your article, Professor, you mentioned the ozone hole over the Arctic and other parts of the world, and you just alluded to the Montreal Protocol and its importance in limiting ultraviolet radiation damage to the skin, eyes, and organ. You have some beautiful simulations showing what would happen to the incidence of melanoma, for example, if we don't pay attention to the Montreal Protocol. Would you be so kind to tell our readers what is the Montreal Protocol and what is its importance in human health?
Thank you, Professor Matalon. The Montreal Protocol was a protocol that was created about 4 years after the discovery of the Antarctic ozone hole. It was first discovered by scientists here in Greece at the Quadrennial Ozone Symposium in Chalkidiki, Greece. And it has been explained by British colleagues from the British Antarctic Survey. And the paper you mentioned that we did some years after had to do with its global appearance. The depletion of ozone overhead was a global phenomenon, but it was maximizing its horrifying appearance over the Antarctic at the beginning of the records, and then we saw it also in the Arctic. What was happening and what is still happening is that the Antarctic and Arctic stratospheres, they include a polar vortex, which is a vortex, a rotating part of the atmosphere, which is cold because it is more cold at the end of the Arctic and Antarctic winter. And in these cold conditions, the substances that are released from chlorofluorocarbons, chlorine, for instance, and its oxides, they can attack the ozone molecules and destroy ozone. We have witnessed in the past areas where there had been no ozone up in the upper layers of the atmosphere. So the Montreal Protocol was an international agreement to ban these chlorofluorocarbons and introduce other substances that they don't harm the ozone layer. They include a hydrogen atom, which is changing their stability characteristics, so they dissolve in the lower layers of the atmosphere and they do not penetrate the stratosphere, which is higher, and therefore they are diluted on Earth. But at the same time, the same substances are very strong greenhouse gases. So we have the replacement substances are strong greenhouse gases. And to heal the ozone hole, we have used substances that they contribute to global warming. So the Montreal Protocol was signed, as I said, in 1987, and it controls about 100 substances that are forbidden to be used. Of course, there is always globally a contrabando in some countries. There are always other ways that some people are still using molecules that include chlorine, and they continue harming the ozone layer. But it is considered, the Montreal Protocol, as the most successful protocol ever. It started with a few dozen of countries, and now all United Nations countries, more than 200, they have signed it. So it's a global protection system, very effective, successful, because it has stopped the rapid decline of ozone, of our protective ozone layer. And it is estimated that if the Montreal Protocol has not been issued by the year 2030, which is 7 years after from now, we would have had about 2 million cases of skin cancer extra in view of the ozone depletion that we would have had without the Montreal Protocol. So we avoided a world which was dangerous for our children and grandchildren with the Montreal Protocol.
Thank you very much. This is absolutely fantastic. It is wonderful to see scientists get together for the common good. And as you mentioned in your article, in addition to melanoma and other forms of skin cancer, there is also worry about cataracts, erythema, and various other eye diseases that can be easily catastrophic to human health. So, Professor Zerefos, there are many concerns, as you mentioned, about global warming and the catastrophic effects it has on the environment. How does depletion of the ozone layer may contribute to global warming?
Well, global warming would affect the stratosphere, but we still do not know how much it would change the polar vortices, both in the Antarctic and in the Arctic. We have a big research program here in Europe. The Academy of Athens participates in that project. And we have been examining the behavior of ozone, and we model ozone on a day-to-day basis. It is called CAMS, C-A-M-S, comes from the Copernicus system, which is a large umbrella of large-scale projects that are funded by the European Union in collaboration with the British medium-range forecasting system, ECMWF. So we saw through that CAMS activity project that we have had the last three winter, spring in the Antarctic, the ozone hole reappeared. Although the global ozone protection is normally not accelerating anymore in its depletion rate, but unfortunately, the last three winters were quite abnormal. And we try to understand that. We know that the dynamics of the vortex have been unusually behaving, in the sense that they come later, they strengthen, they make the polar vortex colder a little later than expected from the previous climatology of the Arctic and Antarctic in the stratosphere. So we suspect that our climate models could perhaps explain that change, which definitely affects ozone. But on the other hand, we do have the last assessment of WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, and UNEP, the United Nations Environment Program, who are doing regular estimates of the state of the ozone layer and the UVB situation. And the last statement, which came out last year, the end of 2022, it is stated that actually we do see a slow recovery, or say the long-term decrease of the protective ozone layer stopped, and we don't see it becoming worse. But what we see are hints of abnormal individual winter springtime in the Antarctic and in the Arctic, which are alarming as to how much the global warming, which is destabilizing our global climate, and it is actually affecting also the stratosphere, would have adverse effects in the future. Because, you know, one characteristic of the global destabilization of our climate is that we do expect an increase in the extreme events that occur all over the globe. And among these extreme events, we haven't thought of the extreme events in the stratosphere. So now we are concentrated 20 kilometers above to see what will happen in this evolving global warming, which is dangerous, and we definitely need to understand. You know, science never stops. So we definitely need to get reorganized to maybe to have the Montreal Protocol 2, where both substances that harm the ozone layer, but also global warming, greenhouse gases, should both be controlled. And there are arrangements, international, like decisions taken in Africa at Kigali and other that are outside of the time we have for this podcast.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating. And I am sure, you know, we have noticed even in Alabama, extreme weather changes. For the first time in I don't know how many years, we had deep freeze that really destroyed a lot of my plants in my garden. It's unprecedented, and a large number of tornadoes and so on. So all of your efforts on this are greatly appreciated. They have a tremendous effect, not only directly on our health, but also for our well-being, because these catastrophic events with the weather cause a lot of damage. Professor Zerifos, you may be very much interested to know that I have asked another fellow Greek, Dr. Stavros Garagiotis, to write about the harmful effects of ozone. Of course, ozone is very important in the upper stratosphere. On the other hand, ozone is an oxygen gas, as you know, and when generated in the lower atmosphere, contributes a lot to respiratory illnesses. For example, exacerbates asthma to a large extent and chronic obstructive lung disease. So we have the yin and yang, if you will, and it is important. And for that reason, Kara is going to help us organize a webinar in a few months where we talk about these various aspects of ozone and other pollutants in great detail. So in closing, Professor, you are the head of the Research Center for Atmospheric Physics and Climatology in the Academy of Athens. Can you tell us right now some of the major research endeavors in your laboratory and how do these affect the environment?
Yes, thank you, Professor Matalon. Our laboratory is working for decades now in the stratosphere and the Earth's climate. We have a station, in fact, we have established three spectrophotometric stations in Thessaloniki, Athens. One operated for 10 years in the Arctic area outside of Reykjavik in Iceland. And in view of the fact that we couldn't afford maintaining it in the Arctic, we had to bring the whole station back to Greece. So we have experimental measurements of total ozone, of UVB, of course. We are calculating daily the UVB doses. We are part of international networks, which are being informing people also via our mobile phones. You can get the exposure to UVB doses. All these come from people like us. There are hundreds now all over the globe. And at the same time, we do monitor the bad ozone, as you mentioned before, which is the ozone that irritates the respiratory system of humans and irritates the eyes. And we all know it from the Los Angeles smog period now with the Clean Air Acts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 6, you know, 11, etc. We know that has disappeared because we have improved the engines of the cars, which were mostly responsible for that cloud that we breathe. Now, these measurements also contribute to allergic situations, and springtime is the best time to study them. So we do that, and we have the innovative system of laser radars. We scan the atmosphere to look for the 3D profile of aerosols, which are small particles, you know, they are floating in the atmosphere, but they are carriers of everything from, you know, allergic allergogens and other substances. So we do that. And at the same time, of course, we have and we participate in modeling of climate change. We participate with the IPCC, the International Climate Monitoring System. And also we participate in various global projects. I think you might be interested to know that we are now focusing on an initiative that we started from Greece. It is called the Greek Initiative, and it has been adopted by His Excellency, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Gutierrez, and it has to do to the protection of monuments from extreme weather events and their consequences. So we have already published papers, and we have a small group that is working on cultural heritage. So it's an active group. We are 12 scientists there, and we have three affiliated laboratories from actually Thessaloniki, from Patras, and in Athens, the universities. But at the same time, we have been closely, and we are collaborating with the UK, with Scandinavia, with Oslo. Particularly in the past, we have been collaborating with the University of Oslo. I was part-time there. And we have been interested also in the scientific content on the status of the atmosphere in paintings by great masters for the past 500 years. You know, we don't have data before 100 or so years. We have very few data, but we are trying to understand the absorption and emission capabilities of our atmosphere through the eyes of great painters. And we published several papers on that issue. So we now continue to do all these aspects, plus provide support to our government in the international obligations that Greece has in terms of global warming. Our measures were among the first countries in Europe to take stringent measures to reduce the carbon footprint of our country. We now have renewable, our energy comes, more than 40% of our energy comes from renewable energy resources, which is very high.
Impressive.
Yes. We continue in serving our community, the international community, and of course we love culture, and we try now to see culture not to be damaged by mistakes, either in the construction, the surrounding the monuments, but also in the severe weather events that can deteriorate monuments of all humanity. Lastly, I would like to add that ozone, that the word ozone comes from the Greek word I smell, ozo, ozin. So yes, it's actually the first time that ozone is mentioned is in the Odyssey, and it's actually described as the smelling of Jupiter when he throws his thunder. And indeed, when a thunder is coming from the clouds, you know, there is a smelling around, which is actually the smelling of ozone. It's a gas that was discovered in the 19th century.
Well, this is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, it is very important as a fellow Greek to know that our heritage is preserved and we do everything to preserve it. And we have heard a lot of things like the acid rain and, of course, how the ozone may affect monuments and so on. So, Professor Zerefos, we are really grateful to you and your team for taking the time to write this highly insightful paper and for taking the time to do this podcast. Kara, would you like to add anything? Do you have any questions for Professor Zerefos?
Mostly, I just wanted to say thank you for making these very complex concepts that are affecting all of humanity very digestible and understandable. And I think that is your gift as not only a scientist, but a science communicator. It is, I'm sure, very difficult to boil down these exceptionally complex concepts that are therefore understandable to scientists in many different fields. So I deeply appreciate it that you have that gift and that you're willing to share it with the Physiological Reviews podcast today.
He's a truly delightful person. And his wife, Effie, is a wonderful person as well. And so
undoubtedly
and reciprocally, Leanne and you and Kara, thank you so much. It has been wonderful collaborating with you, and maybe we can have the great honor and the opportunity to continue in the future.
Of course.
Because I consider that some of the work we plan now we plan to make a huge review on every paper that has been, or article that has been published concerning paintings and their physiological content, because the perception of colors, you know, it's a big story and has to do with the eyes, the physics of the eyes, the optics, and also of the brain.
I would like to offer my sincere thanks to Professor Zerefos for writing this insightful article and for this podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sadis.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. For more episodes like this one, visit journals.physiology.org/journal/physrev, or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify.